Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Welcome back to another episode. I'm your host, Jeff Palermo, and this week we're going to be talking about Steven Spielberg's AI, Artificial Intelligence. Before we do that, let's get to feedback and a little genre news. As far as feedback goes, I would like to give a very warm thanks to David Alexander. He sent me a wonderful email in response to my The Force Awakens podcast, appreciating the podcast and what I had to say. He also suggested The Black Hole as a possible subject for a future show, and I went ahead and screened it, and in my estimation, it didn't really hold up. I just didn't feel like I could do a really good show on The Black Hole, but I'm really glad to see it again anyway. The Cygnus looked really great, and it was, you know, kind of fun to relive it a little bit, but sometimes you can't go home again. And also, I want to thank David for pledging on Patreon. David is now a Patreon member of Sci-Fi on Screen, so just to remind you guys, you can go to Patreon and you can pledge a certain amount of money per podcast. You can go as low as a dollar per podcast, $4 a week, 52 weeks a year. If you really like the show, it's a great way to show your appreciation. And it helps me cover costs for making the show. So anyway, thanks again to Dale Alexander. Really like a super fan this week. I want to thank David Melville, Matt Hart, Chris Guinard, David Alexander again, HedgeKnight84, and Kieran Swain for retweeting Star Wars The Force Awakens on Twitter. Another great way to show your support for Sci-Fi on Screen. Retweet me, man. Get me out there. Recommend me to people, you know. Would really appreciate it. I also want to thank Carlo Moran and Joseph Okpaku for reaching out and commenting on my Facebook page on The Force Awakens. Very appreciative posts on the Facebook page. Guys, thank you so much. Really appreciate that. So a little bit of genre news. Couldn't find much. I think I kind of blew my wad last week. Couldn't find much this week. J.J. Abrams was recently here in New York, and he did a one-on-one conversation with Chris Rock. I think Borough of Manhattan Community College. Go Borough of Manhattan Community College. During the interview, he mentioned that Rey's parents were not in episode 7. So take that as it may. So what, you know, all of us Star Wars fans are kind of realizing is that not Luke's daughter. That's kind of what we're getting. So, you know, who Rey is, who her folks are, a mystery that has yet to be revealed. So kind of interesting. And the reviews for Civil War are dropping and they are astonishingly good. It's being called like the greatest comic book movie ever made, hitting it out of the park. So a lot of amazing reviews are happening out there, Rotten Tomato and Metacritic. I haven't read any of them because I'm going to see it the day after it comes out. But it'll be interesting. You know, one of the worst ones to be released, which I felt Batman v Superman was, followed by like what are people calling one of the best to be ever done. So quite a year in comic book films. All right, so let's do a little background about AI, artificial intelligence. Kubrick began development on an adaptation of a short story by Brian Aldiss entitled Super Toys Last All Summer Long in the 70s, amazingly enough. Hiring the author, Brian Aldiss, to write a film treatment in typical Kubrick fashion, you know, it took forever. In 1985, Kubrick brought longtime friend Steven Spielberg on board to produce the film, along with Jan Harlan. Warner Brothers agreed to co-finance AI and cover distribution. The film labored in development hell, and Aldiss was fired by Kubrick over creative differences in 1989. Sci-fi author Bob Shaw served as a writer briefly, leaving after 6 weeks because of Kubrick's demanding work schedule. He hired a sci-fi author named Ian Watson in March 1990. At that point, I think Kubrick handed Watson The Adventures of Pinocchio for inspiration. So he was, I think the Pinocchio thing came later. And if you read Super Toys, it really is sort of the first hour of the film, and Pinocchio is sort of like the second hour, and then the last bit, pretty much original. So Kubrick told Watson, quote, "I want this to be a picaresque robot version of Pinocchio," unquote. 3 weeks later, Watson gave Kubrick his first story treatment and concluded his work on AI. In May 1991, he gave him another treatment. Gigolo Joe was originally conceived as a GI mecha, so general infantry mecha, but Watson suggested changing him into a male prostitute. Kubrick joked, quote, "I guess we lost the kiddie market," end quote. But of course, in the meantime, Kubrick dropped AI to work on a film adaptation of the Louis Begley novel Wartime Lies, which he was hustling to completion, but Spielberg beat him to the punch with Schindler's List, so he dropped it. And also, he didn't feel the computer animation was advanced enough to do justice to the film. But Jurassic Park came out, and when Kubrick saw Jurassic Park, he thought, this is it. And they announced that in November 93, the production would begin in 94. They hired a guy named Dennis Muren and Ned Gorman, who worked on Jurassic Park, to become the visual effects supervisors. But the pre-visualizations they did, Kubrick was not happy with. So it kind of dragged for a bit. Kubrick showed Spielberg at one point 650 drawings, which he had, and the script and the story, basically everything. And said, quote, "Look, why don't you direct it and I'll produce it," end quote. And, you know, Spielberg was in shock. In 94, the film was in pre-production with an artist named Christopher Baker as a concept artist. This woman named Sarah Maitland assisting on the story, giving it sort of a feminist fairy tale focus. Maitland said that Kubrick never referred to the film as AI, but as Pinocchio, which is interesting. And Chris Cunningham, the director of really interesting music videos, became the new visual effects supervisor. Some of his unproduced work for AI can be seen on his DVD, the work of director Chris Cunningham. And you can tell some of the AI work that made it into the final film was definitely, you know, furthering of some of his work as well. Cunningham helped assemble a series of little robot-type humans for the David character. He says, quote, "We tried to construct a little boy with a movable rubber face to see whether we could make it look appealing," end quote. Producer Jan Holland reflected, quote, "But it was a total failure. It looked awful," end quote. Hans Moravec, who's this hardcore scientist, was brought in as a technical consultant. Meanwhile, Kubrick and Holland thought AI would be closer to Spielberg's sensibilities as a director. So Kubrick handed the position to Spielberg in 95, but Spielberg chose to do other stuff and convinced Stanley to remain as the director. Again, it was put on hold when Stanley committed to Eyes Wide Shut. And then Kubrick died right as Eyes Wide Shut was being released in 99. And after his death, Christiane Kubrick, Kubrick's wife, and Jan Holland, the producer, approached Spielberg to take over the director's seat. And I think out of respect and sort of dedication to Stanley, he did. So by November 99, we're in fast track. Spielberg was writing the screenplay based on Watson's 90-page treatment. It was the first solo screenplay credit that Spielberg had since Close Encounters in 1977, so pretty interesting there. Spielberg remained pretty close to Watson's treatment, but removed various sex scenes with Gigolo Joe, no surprise there. Pre-production was briefly halted in February 2000 because Spielberg pondered directing other projects, which were Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, Minority Report, and Memoirs of a Geisha. Following month, he announced that AI would be his next project. He committed to it, and that Minority Report would be the follow-up. At that point, he fast-tracked it. The film was budgeted at $100 million. It made $236 million, so considered a box office success. Not a smash, but, you know, doubled its money. Maybe not when you consider marketing, which they never put in the budget numbers. Rotten Tomatoes, at this point, still 73%, which is pretty respectable, and a 65 on Metacritic. So we start out with a voiceover from Ben Kingsley, shots of the ocean, and we're getting a lot of information sort of setting the stage in our future world. The ice caps have melted, drowning most of the coastal cities. Because of that, there's been an incredible migration of people from the coast inland, creating lots of overcrowding. From that, we get that population controls have been enacted in most countries. Pregnancy has to be sort of sanctioned. It has to be won by lottery, which prompted the sort of robotic revolution in terms of, you know, pets or servants and so on and so forth. So kind of interesting, you know, never quite heard a future history set up like that, you know, where the drowned coastlines push people in and actually cause population overcrowding, which is an interesting sort of setup, kind of like it. So we start out at Cybertronics, which is a maker of robots. We start out at the Cybertronics sort of headquarters, which, you know, looks like it could be in an Apple headquarters. And we get this long speech by probably president and CEO, Professor Alan Hobby, played by William Hurt. And he's talking about, you know, how far they've come in creating synthetics. And a synthetic is sitting at a table nearby amongst all the employees. And she looks extremely lifelike, so much so that he stabs her with a, you know, some kind of needle. And, you know, the audience kind of jumps. But she says, ow, but it's simulated pain. When he asks her, like, what do you feel about what I just did? She has no emotions. So there's a neat little scene right here where he opens her face, like he puts his finger like in her mouth, upper palate, and pushes a button, and her face kind of splits in half, and he takes out a little CPU. Really neat. Really just like you don't expect it, you know? So it's kind of a cool little moment in the film. Hobby is kind of frustrated at their plateau right now, and he wants to build a robot that can love. A child robot, and he thinks that there's a huge market out there for couples who cannot, you know, gain sanction to have a child, or who don't win the lottery, you can't have children, and that it would fulfill a huge need in the society. And he ends this whole thing with a quote: "In the end, didn't God create Adam so he could love him?" So I don't know, kind of interesting setup. We get a title card after that, 20 months later, and then we're kind of driving in this really cool kind of futuristic mix between a car and a motorcycle, which I kind of like. And we meet the Swintons, Monica and Henry. Henry works for Cybertronics, which we'll find out about very soon. And they go to a company called Cryogenics. And it seems like their son has fallen ill with some malady that can't be cured. But cryogenic science has grown to such a degree that, you know, they can put their son in suspended animation until possibly a cure for what he has is created. But you hear the cryonics scientist talking to the husband, and it's like she can't grieve. Like it's almost worse that the son has died. I mean, the son, what he says is beyond their science, but she can't cut the cord and grieve because he's not actually technically dead. So, you know, she's in some suspended place emotionally that's just going to, you know, drag out forever, which is kind of an interesting setup emotionally for what's going to come. We see Pinocchio murals on the wall. You know, she's reading, I believe, Pinocchio to him, maybe one of his favorite books. So beginning of weaving the Pinocchio story through this film. And we don't, it's great. He cuts right to the chase, Spielberg. The next scene is Henry surprising her by bringing home David. We assume after having seen the speech at the beginning of the film that David is actually the first prototype of, you know, the boy that can love. And the fact that Henry works for Cybertronics, he was chosen by the company that kind of because of the illness of their son, you know, that is, this is a perfect candidate to send the boy into and see how things go. Henry brings home David, who is none other than Haley Joe Osment, Mr. Sixth Sense himself. So Monica, of course, is freaking out, crying. He's got to get out of the house. And Henry's like, you know, and basically he did it because he's trying to sort of wake her up again because she's been in some fugue, you know, with her son, Martin, in cryo fugue. And it's good that she freaks out. You know, the film really gives it this moment because, you know, obviously, you know, she's going to think that how could she love someone else? Her son's in, you know, cryo fugue. So it's really good. And, you know, this whole part of the film with David and then Martin eventually is just Spielberg at his best. I mean, he really has a feel, and Kubrick was so right about his sensibilities and being in tune to the material. So then they come up with this, the imprinting process, which is really neat. So, you know, right now David's just kind of like a robot very similar to other robots, or Mecha as they're called. So it's Orga and Mecha are the little nicknames, which, I don't know, they don't really roll off the tongue. Kind of, you know, when you come up with new, like, sci-fi names, man, you got to work them, you know, like Orga Mecha just doesn't, I don't know, it's a little clumsy. But anyway, so David's kind of a regular Mecha, and it takes imprinting, you know, and this, it's funny that they've taken this concept in the film from actual imprinting, which happens from babies and mothers, you know, when a baby's with a mother for a certain period of time, it's imprinted on her, you know, sights, sounds, smells. So they totally stole it, which I think is genius. And there's an interesting line here that I like that, you know, the husband is like, don't do it until you're sure. And she's like, silly man, of course I'm not sure. And that, you know, this notion of like when to have children, right? Or is anyone ever sure about this kind of a commitment in one's life? So I like that it's done in that way where she's sort of like, you know, come on, dude. no one's ever sure. You just kind of, you get a gut reaction and you go for it and you make the best of it, you know? So for the first couple of days, he's just kind of around the house. He works, she's home. He's around the house kind of following her, freaking her out. He's just there, present, standing, observing. She tries to ignore him and it's, you know, it's okay. He tags along with her. Later, the three of them are sitting at the dinner table and he's mimicking them eating. Of course, he can't eat. And he has this moment where I think something's hanging out of her mouth. He sees it and starts laughing. So there is this sense that he does have a pretty intense amount of intelligence that he would understand a joke. And his laugh makes her laugh, which makes Henry laugh. So you get a sense it's like the first good laugh the family has had in a long time. You know, the first night she wanted the father to put him to bed. The second night after the laughing scene, now she's putting him to bed. She's touching him. You know, they're getting a little closer. And what I like in this opening scene with the mother and David is there's a lot of silence. It's like a silent movie. There's a lot of drama and intention is conveyed by looks, by action. Not a lot of dialogue. And I think Spielberg was really, you know, leaning on his strengths when he wrote this, that he could convey the mood of what's going on, and he didn't have to have a lot of dialogue in the sequence. I think he nailed it. Really, really well done. Finally, at one point, she gives in. She imprints him, which is this cool process where she reads certain words, and then he looks at her, and then instead of saying Monica, he starts calling her Mommy, which is a pretty powerful moment. And then she gives him a gift of Teddy, and now Teddy is sort of like what's called a super toy, and I think they got this from, obviously, from Aldous's story, Super Toys Last All Summer Long. And in the story, you have a very intelligent robot as a boy, and that boy had a little teddy, and they call him a super toy as well. And it's sort of a semi-smart teddy bear, which I'm a huge fan of Teddy. I think for whatever reason, it's got to be personal with me. I'm not really sure why, but whenever Teddy's on screen, there are sometimes he gets into some hazardous situations later on. I'm just like I'm so a mess watching him, you know, when he gets lost or when people take him. He's so helpless. And he's got a really beautiful sounding voice. And I don't know, I really think Teddy is like a triumph character design. Everything's honky-dory for a bit. And then quickly we get into the next escalation where their son Martin wakes up from whatever thing that he had. He's cured by modern science. And so he's back. And Martin's a bit of a dick. So, you know, where Monica was treating David like a boy, Martin's treating David like one of his toys. You know, David is very naive, not human, so he doesn't have this sense of cunning and competition in a certain sense. So they start off where they both sit there and they're like, let's see who Teddy comes to first. And Teddy runs away and actually runs towards the mother and takes off, which is kind of funny. Then there's kind of an interesting sequence where Martin really earnestly is asking David, what does he remember? And he talks about a memory of a bird. It's the first memory that he has. And I think we see it earlier in the film. It's the logo of Cybertronics, but he just sort of remembers it as a bird figure. They all read Pinocchio now. So, you know, the mother reads it with David, the mother reads it with Martin. But David, as David's listening to the story, you know, Martin's just kind of listening to it like it's a cool story. But when David's hearing it, you could tell he's really latching onto it, you know. He has a brief dream of being a real boy, right? Which is the story of Pinocchio at the end. He becomes a real boy via the blue fairy. So next scene, there's this dinner table scene where Martin sort of goads him into eating too much and he's not supposed to eat. And guys from Cybertronics have to come and sort of empty him out. And so it's kind of weird. They're all watching him and he's completely upended and opened up inside and they're pulling spinach out of him. And, you know, just kind of to remind the family that he's actually a robot, which is kind of interesting. And then Martin does a really, really horrible thing where he's like, if you do this thing for me, I'll love you, which will make Mommy love you, and to sneak into their room and with a scissor cut a lock of her hair. So, of course, you know, David being very naive, right? And it's a heartbreaker to watch. It's a heartbreaker for me to watch David being sort of manipulated by Martin. It's really tough. Just, I think personally, it's very hard for me to watch that. So Spielberg really gets me. He really nails me in this. And he sneaks into the bedroom. And he does cut a lock of the hair, which falls down and Teddy catches, which, of course, we'll have later. But, of course, in that moment, and this is Spielberg in top tension form. It's gut-wrenching because we know he's going to get caught. And they both completely freak out. Monica wakes up and the point of the scissor is like right by her eye. Henry freaks out. He doesn't rat Martin out, you know, which is weird. But Henry now is sort of against David and he's starting to have these conversations with Monica. like he's not a real boy and the safety and, you know, we may not want him here. And then there's just a heartbreaker of a scene. It's Martin's birthday party. Martin and his douchebag friends are all like gathered around David, you know, as boys will do, and they're like, what can you do? And one of the friends is like, oh, I'm going to trigger his danger avoidance response. All robots have it. So he pricks him with like a piece of a knife. So David does go into danger avoidance, but he winds up holding on to Martin too tightly, falls into the pool and holds him down. And would have drowned Martin, but not for, you know, Henry diving in and grabbing him, and they have to do CPR on Martin. And there's this whole sequence where Spielberg keeps the camera below the waves from David's point of view, and we see sort of shadows out above the water as they have to do CPR on him, and, you know, the jiggling of Martin's foot when he actually coughs up the water and wakes up. So pure Spielbergian tactile gold, as he does so well. So we know at this point, you know, he's gone. We can tell that the parents are going to figure out a way to do it. Monica goes into David's room and she starts seeing these writings that he has done where it's like, mommy, I love you this, mommy, I love you that, like 7 or 8 pages of just like pouring out his heart to her. And she starts crying because we know it's too late. So she's like, we're going to go driving in the woods tomorrow, just you and I and Teddy. So she takes him in the middle of the woods. Well, first she's taking him back to Cybertronics and she gets to like the driveway of Cybertronics and has some crazy guilt reaction because they realize that if she brings him back, you know, part of the deal with imprinting is he can't be given to any other. He will only love Monica and Monica only forever. So he would have to be kind of destroyed and reprogrammed. And so she kind of chickens out at the last minute and dumps him in this woods somewhere with Teddy and drives away. But it's a hell of a scene because the woman playing Monica really, really sells it. I mean, just a mother, you know, it is like abandoning a child to a certain degree. She really did come to love David and tells it for the first time. She says briefly, you know, stay away from flesh fairs, stay with Mecca, your own kind, stay away from human beings, and basically drives away. Done. First hour of the movie, you know, we've gotten basically David, this whole emotional setup, which I think is great. I really like that they spend this much time setting up the emotional stakes about what David is and what he's gone through and, you know, what happened to him and how he was manipulated and ditched. And so at this point in the movie, I think this movie has a lot of problems, but an hour in, man, I'm like, holy cow. And what I want to say this is that the movie from the beginning of the movie to right now is an extremely realistic. And why I'm saying that is that, you know, they're doing this for Fable, right? I think at the end of the movie, this movie gets tripped up in a certain sense because it's arguably a fairy tale, right? But it sets up being a very realistic story, futuristic story. And things are going to change from here on out. For me, it doesn't work. The mashing two of them together doesn't work. Very similar in a way what Kubrick did with Eyes Wide Shut, where the whole thing's supposed to be a dream, but he films things too realistically. And so I never buy that it's a dream. I never buy that we're in this hypnotic world when it's so tactilely represented and everything is so realistic and natural. To come back at the end and say the whole thing was kind of a dream sequence, it may or may not have been real. And I think that's kind of what happens to AI too in the second half, where, and I'll get to that, because it tries to go full-on dream sequence, and I just think it's problematic as we go. So now we shift away from David, and for the first time we meet Gigolo Joe, played by Jude Law, who is amazing in this film. I mean, he is exactly that. He is a male gigolo, male prostitute, whatever they're called. We start out with him with a woman in this scene, and she's a little hesitant, you know, first time with a mecha. Will it hurt? And we see that she's been brutalized, which I kind of like. You know, her human husband beats her, so she needs to come to this machine for love and affection. And of course, you know, Gigolo Joe's program is exactly that. He has this thing where like he turns on and off music by jerking his head to the left or the right, which is kind of weird. So he can like be walking down the street, jerk his head to the left, and all of a sudden you're hearing like romantic music coming from him. It's kind of funny. And when he leaves after the encounter with this woman, he walks outside and we're in some like Amsterdam, Vegas, London of A Clockwork Orange. Like it's some super futuristic thing, but it's also very like Day Glow 60s. It's weird. The production design in AI is really weird. I never quite bought it. It's a little too show busy, a little too Hollywood for me, but it's very striking. He arrives for his next assignation with a woman. And when he gets up there, we realize she's been killed. Her boyfriend is suddenly there behind him. We realize that he is going to frame Gigolo Joe for the murder. So Gigolo Joe realizes like he's dead meat. So he runs out. These mecha have their licenses. When he pulls his shirt back, there's like a little glowing strip where you might wear a patch on a shirt, but it's actually in his skin, and it's his sort of mecha license. To the murder, we see Gigolo Joe take out a scalpel, and we realize he's going to remove his. So he's on the run from the law. Then we cut back to David and Teddy, and it's basically the quest for the Blue Fairy. This is David's thing. He's like, you know, if we find the Blue Fairy, she'll turn me, make me a real boy, and then Mom will love me, and I can go back home again. So we've got the quest. I love the first scene here where he's present at a dump truck, kind of comes into the woods and just dumps an enormous pile of used robot parts, heads and legs and torsos, and they dump it and leave. And then out of nowhere, swarming come all these mecha, all in various states of disrepair. You know, they've been hiding out. They're sort of like a mecha underground where they hide from human beings to avoid being captured. So you see them wading through these parts. It's really terrific. You see them, you know, interchanging old beat up arms for new arms. One person didn't have a jaw, so he finds a lower jaw and inserts it into his neck cavity, and it doesn't quite match, but it does work. So great special effects in that some of these mecha have like half faces or just the front of a face and behind it is empty, and we see that, you know. So the effects are really well done with the mecha. It looks very realistic. It does not look CGI. I mean, very crisp, very sharp effects work here. Also, Jude Law is wonderful as Gigolo Joe because of the way he moves his body, very precise movements. The costume design is really cut tight to fit his body. He doesn't blink. Nobody blinks. And I think it was a Haley Joel Osment thing, actually, where he suggested to Spielberg that his character not blink. And when Spielberg saw how well it worked, he suggested that none of the androids would blink in the film. Some of them do, and it's a goof, but the idea is that they don't. But again, Jude Law is really terrific. He's really... It gives a very physical performance with Gigolo Joe and very precise movements that you would expect from a machine, and I think Law really nails it. So now we get the Flesh Fair sequence, and it starts with all of the mechs who are going through the refuse look over the hill, and we see this incredible glowing moon come over the rise. And, you know, at first it's a very unsettling image. We don't realize what the hell's going on because the moon is shot in a way that makes it look unbelievably real. But it turns out that it's a balloon shaped like a moon. And in the gondola is Brendan Gleeson, the actor, as the ringmaster of the Flesh Fair, Lord Johnson Johnson, which is kind of funny. So he's in the gondola and they're looking at all the mecha that are running. And they pick up Gigolo Joe. They first think he's a human. They realize that he's not. He's like fresh out of human society. So they hunt and then they have... these motorcycle riders done up in like neon with their these sort of hound masks put over their motorcycle, and you know, Lord Johnson Johnson says like, unleash the hounds on the rest and let's bag, you know, Gigolo Joe basically. So then there's a sequence with the, you know, these motorcycles driving through the area, you know, and they're shooting these, first of all, they're shooting these magnets that once they hit the mechas, they grab the mechas and pull them into whatever nearest metal that's nearby, which, okay, it's kind of cool. They have to get them out of the woods, of course, to do that first. They're riding through the fog a lot with the spotlights of the bike. So classic Spielberg, the man loves light. He loves spotlights and Klieg lights and, you know, from E.T. onward, you know, whenever he can do like lights coming over a hill or fog, like he does a lot of that here, which is, you know, it's just his signature. So Gigolo Joe is there running. David is there running with Teddy. They're all kind of going pell-mell and they all get caught except for Teddy. And it's a really touching scene when they're pulling the net up and David is caught in the net with the rest of them. Gigolo Joe was caught by the gondola and the balloon and he's caught separately. But Teddy is trying to stay with David, but he wasn't caught. So he's hanging onto the outside of the net. It's just kind of a little heartbreaker of a scene. But of course, Teddy drops. He is okay. And he follows them to the Flesh Fair, which is where they're all going. So kind of Teddy's on his own right now, which is, I don't know, for me, it's like a heartbreak over this little super toy teddy bear running around, you know, who's so helpless. It's just, I don't know, it's very heart-rending for me to watch. So the band playing at the Flesh Fair is none other than Germany's Ministry. Spielberg heard someone in the cast or in the crew playing them and he was like, "Wait, that's the band. Who are these guys? We got to use them." So Ministry is there. And then we get a long tracking shot. Basically, Teddy is found by someone at the fair and, you know, it's a fairly well-done kind of country fair. And they have a lost and found. And so this woman throws Teddy to one of the guys and said lost and found. So we now track this guy as he carries Teddy through the fair. You know, as tracking shots go, it's not the best mounted. It's not the most interesting tracking shot. You are getting the sort of the pell-mell of the fair. It's basically like your basic fair. A lot of people in running around and cotton candy and all this stuff. And so you get kind of a kaleidoscopic view of the fair as you follow this guy who dumps Teddy unceremoniously in a little in a bin labeled, you know, lost and found, and then takes off. And the whole time, Teddy, you hear Teddy's voice like, "Do you know David? I need to find David. How can I find David?" You know, like it's such a heartstring tugger for me. I don't know why. And the tracking shot's just too fast, I think. Spielberg, he's not like the tracking shot guy. Like, you know, Kubrick can do it. Scorsese can do it. Spielberg kind of throws a lot in as you're going. So you can't linger on much. And I don't really get a sense of this fair. I think that he wants me to because of the shot. So I just found that interesting. Of course, in the middle of this whole flesh fair, I mean, the whole idea of the flesh fair is that human beings, these fundamentalist human beings, are going around saying that robots are just against nature and they're horrible. So they collect Mecha and they put them through these torture devices on stage. They light them on fire and shoot them through fan blades. They put them underneath vats of acid. And the Mecha have been very much humanized by us already. You know, they're very kind. They stick together. They all have these sort of forlorn faces. And they were very kind to David when he was captured. And so they're very dignified when they go out and meet their fate. There's one old Mecha who's kind of got his face is kind of detached from his cylindrical body. And he's this old man's face. And he's like, you know, I'm going off to my fate now. And he's very dignified about it. A nanny, I think it was a Mecha nanny, who's really been trying to protect David the whole time, turns to David and winks. And then her face is melted by the acid. So Spielberg does a great job of really, we're for the Mecha here. And we're really astonished and appalled at the human cruelty, that we've kind of seen these Mecha as humanish and kind of having their own little ethos and their own intelligence. But they're just brutalized by this group of people who, you know, are completely and utterly indifferent to anything Mecha. And I think in a weird way, it works this fair in one way. It works emotionally. Visually, I don't think it's a very interesting thing. Things are a little too jumped up in this. It's a little too kind of show busy for me. Like, there are times when I don't think it's quite real. There are times when it's, but it has emotional power, you know, behind it, which is just very odd watching. So then there's this whole thing with David where a young girl sees David in this cage with all the rest of the Mecha, you know, as they're being pulled out and, you know, brutalized and killed. There's one scene before I move on. Chris Rock, it plays a Mecha in this, and, you know, you can tell it's his voice. And he's shot through a cannon, lit on fire, and then, you know, decapitated through these blades. And the faceplate of his Mecha impacts the cage in between the bars of the cage that David is in with the rest of the Mecha, and it's on fire, but it's still kind of conscious and smiling, and it slowly slides down the bar. It's just a really, really creepy, kind of weird scene that I like. I don't know. It's just really cool. But so what I was saying is this young girl sees David in there because he's, most of these Mecha are really kind of like, you know, they're not realistic looking, you know. There's a couple that are, but they've been, you know, kind of brutalized and beat up, and they're, you know, parts of them are missing and or worn away. And David is like, first of all, he's made to be like the perfect image of a boy, and he's, you know, fresh off the factory. So he's mistaken for a boy. So this little girl runs, she's the daughter of the stage manager. They get a camera in, the stage manager looks and he sees David, and they run in there like, you know, this is crazy, this has got to be a boy. So the stage manager brings this little X-ray device. He plays it over David's face and, you know, it can see beneath and we see the mechanism. So the father can tell that it's a Mecha. Lord Johnson Johnson is brought over and they're like marveling at David, like this is a one-of-a-kind unit. And the stage manager's kind of like doesn't want to put it up there. Like he thinks it would be really a horrible thing to do. And Johnson, Lord Johnson Johnson is like, no, this is the very soul of what they're trying to do. They're trying to impersonate and take over. And so he's adamant that David's going to suffer fate. As he drags him out, David has gone into like a damage protection mode and he's clung on to Gigolo Joe, who now gets dragged out with David. And they both get set up underneath the vat of acid, the two of them together. So Lord Johnson Johnson goes into this whole speech. You know, the place quiets down now, and he goes into this whole diatribe about, you know, what these companies are trying to do and how evil Mecca are. But David starts pleading for his life and the crowd responds. And they're like, you know, one girl gets up, Mecca don't plead for their life. And they start pelting Johnson & Johnson with garbage. You know, it's kind of like a little redemption for the crowd in a weird way. And so the crowd now is getting very angry and they're starting to tear the place apart. And David and Gigolo Joe now together are out. And Gigolo Joe now, because David really kind of saved his life in a way, they're kind of now together. Then we cut away from this just briefly, and we cut back to Cybertronics, and we see Alan Hobby, and we kind of pan around his room, and we see pictures of what looked like David, and we realize that the David that he made was a replica of his real son, who, you know, we're not told this, but that died, you know, probably, and that this was his attempt to, you know, sort of bring his son back to life in the image of, you know, David the Mecca. So kind of an interesting cutaway. Just want to take a quick minute to let you know a couple of ways you can support Sci-Fi on Screen. One way is to use Patreon. Patreon is a crowdfunding site that works by allowing users to contribute on a show-by-show basis. All you do is choose a dollar amount you want to contribute, and every time one of my podcasts appears, you'll be debited the amount you choose. You can donate as little as $1 per show. That's $4 a month or $52 a year. No obligation, and you can cancel or adjust the rate at any time. And the best part is it keeps me honest. If there's no show, there's no charge. And it would help to defray hosting costs and for my time to put the shows together. The link is on my website, in the top right-hand corner, and signing up at Patreon is a snap by clicking on Become a Patron. There's also a great way as if you would like to buy the Blu-ray copies of any of the movies that I've reviewed on my podcast. Just simply go to the website, click on the movie page, and go ahead and click on the Blu-ray below the podcast, and it'll take you right to Amazon. If you purchase it, I get a few bucks from that as well. And I always appreciate it if you're on Twitter to retweet my podcast as they appear and spread the word. And the flesh fur scene's weird. Like, I don't visually, for whatever reason, I don't buy it. It's it never really rings true to me. It's kind of like, this is part of the movie that's starting now, where I think the whole first hour of the movie when they're home with the family and the children is so in Spielberg's bag. But the second half of the movie, when they have to do these kaleidoscopic, weird, futuristic landscapes and these things we've never seen before and these harsh conditions, this is so Stanley's bag. I think Spielberg flubs it a little bit. I just think the production design is too, it's too Hollywood. It's too fake. I think Stanley would have done a whole different thing with this. And I think it's kind of jumbled and it's kind of like, I don't know. So the Flesh Fair, although emotionally it was engaging, there was a part of it that I didn't kind of believe too. So at this point in the movie, I'm kind of like, I still got a foot in it, but I don't know what it's trying to become. Like first it's, you know, it started out as this very realistic thing, which was incredibly convincing and emotionally true. And now it's morphing into something else. And I don't think it's as successful as we get into this. So, and I'll kind of keep narrating that as I go. So then we also find out at this point that Cybertronics is tracking David. They know he's alive. They know where he has gone, and they're tracking him. So we get this little bit of information, too, which is just a very unrealistic part of the film that they're going to, like, you know, they're laying breadcrumbs for him to find to get back to the Alan Hobby. But anyway, more on that later. And what they wanted to talk about, you know, now we're with our main trio that we're with for the last, like, you know, hour of the movie. Which is Gigolo Joe, Teddy, and David. And what I love about the Mecca in general is that Spielberg does capture, like, that the Mecca, they do share a sense of innocence, like, in a weird way, like, in their singular directness of what they are. Like, Gigolo Joe is, like, you know, he was basically made to seduce and make love to women, you know? And so, in that singularity, he's very naive in a weird way, where he's like, hey, you know, this is what I can do, and I'm really great at it. He totally... There's no, like, uber consciousness. Well, there's a little bit with him, and that comes later. But his singular understanding of what he does and what he is very naive. And David is too. David's understanding of, like, I'm going to find the blue fairy. The blue fairy is going to make me into a boy, and I'll be loved again, you know. And then there's just Teddy, who's just along for the ride, who's connected to David. So there is this definite, I mean, as a viewer, I'm really with the three of them. You know, I don't think the movie ultimately does them justice, but I really am with these three. I feel such compassion for them as characters because, you know, I know as a viewer, I kind of know the world, but they don't, you know, even though they're in, especially Gigolo Joe, you know, who's been already kind of manipulated by human beings. He was blamed for that murder, so he's on the run, right? And David also is kind of, he thought he was going to be part of this loving situation for his whole life, and he was dumped at the first sign of trouble, you know? So it's just, there's something about these characters that is really, they're capturing this wonderful naivete and innocence about the Mecca, which is cool. So they get to Rouge City, which is, you know, Las Vegas / Amsterdam kind of thing. Gigolo Joe convinces these young boys that if he goes with them, he'll find them women. And they're like, all right, get in. And they drive through this open mouth, you know, and they have to drive over these causeways over the water to get to Rouge City. It just kind of feels fake. Rouge City, again, just feels like a put-on. It really feels very Hollywood-y. I don't think any futuristic kind of rock and roll city like this would look or feel like this. It just doesn't feel right, something about it. It reminded me of like the production design in the first Tim Burton's Batman, you know, where it's cool. Well, the Batman stuff is cool, right? But there is this sense of like, I don't know, kind of like storybook-ness to it. But in Batman, it's like it kind of wears it on its sleeve. But in this film, they started off so realistically. Now that we're getting into these more extravagant and futuristic landscapes, like they're not as convincingly rendered. So I'm just kind of like, all right, you know, and I'll get to this at the end where I think this film kind of goes off the rails a little bit. But yeah, so, you know, the surroundings now around the characters to me are just not very well done, I thought. So they go into, you know, prototype Google, right? Robin Williams is a holographic Dr. No, K-N-O-W, who's sort of the Google of Rouge City. Of course, you have to pay for the questions. And I really like this. I like the idea of that, like, as a dramatic focal point, you know, David comes up with a certain amount of money, he puts it in, and he gets 7 questions, right? And he's messing up left and right, like he's asking questions by accident. And the Dr. No character is like, oh, you have that answer is this. You have 6 questions. And he finally gets down to Blue Fairy and they have to change their tack. You know, it's almost like Greek mythology where they have to go to the oracle and it depends how they ask a question, you know, or the Sphinx, right? If you don't answer the riddle or something. So, you know, they get all to the questions. And at the end, there's this really kind of beautiful last poem. I think it's a poem by Yeats that's in one of these last answers. And there are hints to, like, you know, where the fountains cry, or the lions cry and all that stuff, which, you know, is kind of where Cybertronics is. So, you know, what they both figure out with the help of Gigolo Joe, that they have to go to the end of the world. And the end of the world is Manhattan, which is, you know, where Gigolo Joe says where no Mecca has ever returned. So basically at this point, you know, David wants to go to Manhattan and Gigolo Joe doesn't want to go. And so Gigolo Joe finally, there's this moment where he becomes a little bit more as a character for me. He has this great monologue, which it's really great, and it really encapsulates the plight of the three Mecca character. So, you know, he's asking David, like, what if the Blue Fairy isn't real? What if she's just magic and made up, you know, the supernatural, blah, 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 and David, like, won't hear it. He's like, no, she has to be real. So I'm going to play a clip from the film, this speech that Gigolo Joe gives, because I think it's really, really powerful. So here it is.
They hate us, you know. The humans, they'll stop at nothing.
My mommy doesn't hate me. Because I'm special and unique. Because there's never been anyone like me before, ever. Mommy loves Martin because he is real, and when I am real, Mommy's going to read to me and tuck me in my bed and sing to me and listen to what I say, and she will cuddle with me and tell me every day, 100 times a day, that she loves me.
She loves what you do for her. As my customers love what it is I do for them. But she does not love you, David. She cannot love you. You are neither flesh nor blood. You are not a dog or a cat or a canary. You were designed and built specific like the rest of us. And you are alone now only because they tired of you or replaced you with a younger model or were displeased with something you said or broke. They made us too smart, too quick, and too many. We are suffering for the mistakes they made because when the end comes, all that will be left is us. That's why they hate us.
And that's just dynamite, man. I mean, It's a mess of a movie, but that's a dynamite quote, and it's exactly what happened to them. And we've seen it happen to Gigolo Joe and to David up till now. So the quote totally rings true character-wise. And it's deep, man. I mean, it's deep stuff, you know? I don't think the movie exploits it enough, because when you get to the end of the movie, there's been so many weird left and right turns that it kind of undercuts itself. But man, it really moved me. It really, you know, I was so with these characters, and then with that quote on top, just really, really powerful stuff. So then they have this very unrealistic action sequence where, you know, Joe is found, right? And he's arrested, and they're going to take him. David jumps in a copter, and through the commotion, Gigolo Joe escapes and jumps into the copter with him. And so they head in this sort of easily pilotable, it's not really a helicopter, but it's sort of just like a little mini transport. And Gigolo Joe basically, you know, has nowhere else to go. So they're both heading off to Manhattan. And then we get this really wonderful production design of a flooded Manhattan. That's really beautiful, man. I mean, really well done. Care was taken to really do it well. Just they take their time. You really get to look around the city. Really beautiful. And of course, the lions that weep are these fountains in front of Cybertronics, which is this lone building that's still inhabited in Manhattan. He sees the poem on a plaque, and they realize he's found, you know, his end of the rainbow, as it were. The thing lands, and he leaves sort of Gigolo Joe there, and he goes off and sort of, you know, into Cybertronics, and he finds a copy of himself in a room, and sort of they're talking to each other, I'm David, whatever, and for the first time, he gets very angry because he's finding out that he's not unique and special as his mother had told him, you know? So in a rage, he destroys the copy of David, and finally, at some point, Alan Hobby comes in to take him and sit him down, and he sort of gets all of this really, really heartbreaking and horrible information that the whole thing was a test. The whole Blue Fairy thing was all set up. They used his love of the fairy tale to kind of, you know, he's like, we've been tracking you. We can't believe you did it. That he's the first true AI. And Hobby has kind of a really cool monologue as well, which I like. Again, I think I really like that it's in the movie, and I really respond to it when I'm hearing it. But I don't think the movie does it justice at the end. So here's Hobby's great monologue.
Until you were born, robots didn't dream, robots didn't desire unless we told them what to want. David, do you have any idea what a success story you've become? You found a fairy tale, and inspired by love, fueled by desire, you set out on a journey to make her real, and most remarkable of all, no one taught you how. We actually lost you for a while. But when you were found again, we didn't make our presence known because our test was a simple one. Where would your self-motivated reasoning take you to the logical conclusion? The blue fairy is part of the great human flaw to wish for things that don't exist, or to the greatest single human gift, the ability to chase down our dreams. And that is something no machine has ever done until you.
I thought I was one of a kind.
My son was one of a kind. You are the first of a kind.
But David is shattered by it, and it's a great scene. He's just completely crestfallen. He's been manipulated and lied to his entire life. His mother has lied to him and told him things that aren't true. He navigated the horrible, treacherous shoals of human society, only to find out that his dream was false as well, and that that was also being manipulated. Like I just feel like what's more interesting about that is what I bring to it. I don't think the movie really pays off on it so much, but the movie does bring it up in me, which I think is really great. But so he's really just crushed by it, and he winds up jumping into the water. Hobby's going to bring him to see the rest of the team, so he goes away to get the rest of the team. On his way out to sit by the ledge, he sees all these multiple versions of David, and then there's a female version. I forget the name of that one, but there's going to be a female version of him as well. One of the boxes is kind of moving a little bit. It's almost like it's coming to life. It's kind of really scary. So he jumps off the ledge. Then this movie starts to really go off the rails. He falls in the water. He sinks down, and a school of fish sort of bring him back up to the surface again. I don't know where that's from. I have no clue, unless they're like mecha fish. It's bizarre. I don't understand it at all. It doesn't make any sense. But Joe finds him. I think when he sinks down, he sees the blue fairy. We don't see that he's seen it. We just see that he's seen something. Then he's pulled back up by Joe. The little helicopter gets to the surface. At this point, Joe then is arrested and magnetically pulled away from David. And he's, you know, that's sort of, it's Joe's last scene in the movie. He's like, goodbye, and he leaves. And then David takes the little craft down and submerges, and Teddy's with him. He finds Coney Island, right? Because they're not far from New York, from Manhattan Island. They're slowly making their way through. I guess, and I've only been to Coney Island once or twice, and I think I was too old to know this. I guess there's some Pinocchio garden or something that you walk through, like the Pinocchio story or something. I don't know if that's true. Anyone from Jersey or New York who knows that could, you know, correct me. But so I think the ship follows that little path, and it ends at the very top where there's a statue of the Blue Fairy, and the craft touches down. And just as it touches down, this Ferris wheel, he had disturbed some cables that now the Ferris wheel let go and traps him there. And nobody knows he's there. And it's just him and Teddy. And he's just out of reach of his dream, the Blue Fairy, which is like, metaphorically, it's pretty brilliant, you know, that like the human condition is being, you know, in a sense, trapped in this place, in this bubble, always kind of out of reach of just what you think your dream is. You know, like it's kind of, I thought that was a really wonderful visualization of that effect of human, you know, of human life, which is really neat. So then the movie completely veers off into this, it gets very sci-fi, but it's very odd. And there's a lot of Ben Kingsley voiceover here. So eons pass, like 2,000 years goes by. There's an ice age. And so what I hate is that we're never told these beings are excavating under the ice, and they're excavating, and we see it's part of Manhattan Island, you know, part of Coney Island is being excavated. They're doing this work. We don't know whether the aliens, I mean, to make sense of the story, I'm assuming that they're the evolved ancestors of robots. You know, they've just turned into these incredibly intelligent beings. Humans are gone. It's just mecha now. But they never tell you that. And it's so many years past. You're just like, so kind of weird flaw in the film. And they're these cool, kind of very long, spindly looking aliens. Kind of nice design. You can, they're shiny, so you can see things passing over their surfaces. They defrost David, basically, and kind of bring him back to life, and he gets out of the, you know, the little pod, and he walks up to the Blue Fairy, and he finally gets to touch the Blue Fairy after like 2,000 years, and she shatters into a million pieces from the cold and age, and down she goes. So the aliens kind of surround him, and they read his mind, and I like that this is a cool scene where the one mecha is reading his mind. We see his memories playing over its face, which is kind of neat, and then another mecha comes behind it and touches it, and we see the images kind of go to that alien, and another one touches it. So in like as they link with each other, they're all sort of sharing David's memories, which is amazing. And from there now, we're back in this. They've built a replica of David's first house when he lived with Monica and Henry, which is very much the end of 2001, you know, when Bowman gets out of the pod and he's in that 17th century drawing room. This is very similar to me in that way. The mechas have recreated it all because they really want him to be happy. They're these very evolved beings. And then we just start with this kind of stuff where, you know, they can bring people back, but they need physical samples. I honestly don't understand the ending of this film, I got to be honest. The main mecha, who now we understand, Ben Kingsley is the main mecha, and the mecha has been narrating this whole thing. So what they can do is if they find a DNA fragment of any organic being, they can bring it back, but only for a single day, because what they're saying is once that being has lived and died, like a space-time pathway has been used. And so even when they bring that person back physically and recreate them and clone them, obviously, you know, they only live for a day because that's as much energy, and that they don't, I guess all of their life force has been already used up in an old space-time pathway. It's bizarre. It makes no sense. But anyway, they set this whole thing up where they can bring David's mother back for one day. And of course, they're warning him not to do it because it can only, and they can only do it once. Like it's, the rules are just arbitrary. You know, they can only bring her back once, it's only for one day, and then they can never bring her back again, right? So then, of course, David's wish is like, well, maybe she'll be the one who stays, blah, blah, blah. So they do it, she comes back, they spend this entire day, you know, I love you, David, I love you, Mom. They're playing in his room, and they're running around with, Teddy is there, and all this, and, you know, it's just his dream day of being loved by his mother. And then, you know, she's in bed at the end, really tired, and we realize that she's about to, you know, and she does go away, as they said. So there's no, shockingly, Spielberg didn't, you know, tweak the movie to suit his purposes, which he can do. And then we're told for the first time that David, when he sleeps that night, actually dreams for the first time. I'm not really sure what that means. And we end. You know, a lot of feelings come up with AI. Like, there's a through line and you know, some characters in it that is very powerful. You know, like I really, really love the human characters are just completely disposable, all of them. But Gigolo Joe and David and Teddy are amazing characters, and the world around them is pretty much just there to, you know, enlarge and deepen their characters, which it does, you know. So I really like them. I really like some of the ideas that are played with in the film. I like Gigolo Joe's little speech about, you know, what mechas are to humans and that they're, you know, they're being played with. But in a sense that mechas are too smart and they can kind of love in a way and humans don't realize it. And so there's this horrible, you know, dysfunction between the two species. I love the Pinocchio myth. You know, I mean, it's such a genius. I mean, Stanley, what a genius he is to come up with this idea to make the Pinocchio myth about a mecha wanting to become a real boy. You know, I think the notion of Pinocchio, I don't know it that well, but I think it's almost, you know, like the moral of the story is like you've become, you know, when you've gone through all these machinations of trying to become a real boy, you kind of are one now anyway. You are real. You don't need to be turned into a boy. You kind of are real already in a weird way. So that doesn't, they don't, and they fumble that, I feel like, because at one point, you know, David does become real. He becomes real and transcends the lies and the manipulations that have happened around him. He becomes his own being. And then 2,000 years pass and he's given mommy for a day. Like, I don't understand how they fumbled the ending, but they completely fumbled it to me. And I can't, so the movie doesn't have a lot of power at the end. When it's over, like, I come away with things that I'm thinking about, and I'm really interested in the themes here, and something about Teddy just always rips my guts out. Like, I don't know what the hell it is. Something psychological with me. It's very powerful, but the movie, to me, fumbles it all, and I think it needed Stanley, man. I mean, you know, and I'm not, you know, I'm not such a Kubrick file. I mean, I don't really like anything he's made after Clockwork Orange, after Barry Lyndon, frankly. You know, like, I could care less about his latter movies. They're all kind of these pretentious, overblown misfires to me. Shining included. Shining, Full Metal Jacket, and Eyes Wide Shut, like, whatever. So, you know, he's a genius. I mean, he's a smart, smart guy. And he, I think he would have done better. I think he would have figured out how to really put this thing through, because, you know, he has a little bit of misanthropy that Spielberg doesn't have. And I feel like it would have worked to good effect here, because it would have really burnished David down, and he would have went for the harder ending. Not that I didn't really know what that is, but the sense that David would have created his own reality, and you didn't need 2,000 years later. I mean, that kind of works in another way. Like, 2,000 years later, he becomes incredibly special, but not because his mother loves him, not because some fake, you know, analog of his mom loves him, but he actually becomes special because of then what he has done and being the first of what he, you know, what he's about. That he's transcended this lie of his mother's love and all that stuff. So the fact that they put him back in this fake little bubble, and that's his journey, and he gets that, to me, kind of undercuts the whole thing of, like, no, he's outside the whole thing now. He's off someplace new, and he's a complete being that now is for himself or for his God, whatever that might be. And he's completely separate from these human myths of that mommy is going to love me and all this crap. And he can define his own love at that point. You know, so, like, my brain kind of kicked in, and I wanted it to go in that way, but it didn't. And also, one thing I want to mention is that the film's strange in that it's very realistic in its first hour, and then very fable-like in its second hour. And I think the juxtaposition is very jarring. I don't think it works. I think if you're going to do a fairy tale the whole way through. And I think the first hour of the film is an incredible, it could be like a TV movie. It's so emotionally realistic. And, you know, it is realistic to an incredible degree. And then you kind of fable out in the last hour. And it just, there's something, also something between those two parts of the movie that, to me, undercuts the power of the whole thing as well. Something's not fitting together in this movie in a way that, you know, I'm trying to come to grips with. And I think it has a lot to do with a bunch of different things, but that's definitely one of them, you know. So in the end, I would say, you know, AI is there's a lot of good things about it. There's a lot of interesting things, great characters, but it doesn't gel. I think it fumbles and fails in a lot of ways, where the movie doesn't really hold up as a whole thing that really works, you know. It's just a really, really interesting film, I will say that, as to what it could have been, what it didn't do, what it does do. But I don't really find that it really, really, you know, hit a home run with the themes that it was juggling, you know, and the ideas. So a little bit of trivia, not too much on this one. Real-life amputees played some of the robots with missing limbs. For the last 7 minutes of the movie, composer John Williams wrote a piano concerto, and it went over the length of the film. So Spielberg stopped the projector and told Williams to just let the music continue. And then Spielberg, along with his editor, Michael Kahn, re-edited the last 7 minutes into the piano concerto. Supposedly, he did a similar thing years before with E.T., where he and this woman, Carol Littleton, who was his editor, edited the last 15 minutes into Williams' ending music. So kind of interesting. The movie was originally to be just titled AI, but after a survey, it was revealed that too many people thought it was A1, the steak sauce. So they changed it to AI, artificial intelligence. And one little last little tidbit, Jerry Seinfeld was originally considered to be a voice and play a comedian robot, which is kind of funny. But yeah, so that's pretty much my take on AI, artificial intelligence, and I'll see you next time.
Thanks once again for listening to Sci-Fi on Screen to my returning listeners and new listeners alike. If you like what you heard, head on over to iTunes and give us a review. We'd love to hear from you. If you have any suggestions about the show, you can send an email to scifionscreen@gmail.com, or feel free to leave a comment on the website www.scifionscreen.com, and you can leave a comment in the comments section of the show page. If you'd like to support scifionscreen.com, you can go to patreon.com/scifionscreen, and that's Patreon is P-A-T-R-E-O-N. And to make it easy on yourself, there is a button on the webpage that you can click. Patreon is set up so you can pick an amount you want to contribute per episode, and it'll be recurring. If you'd like to do that, that is available. We'd appreciate all the support we can get. And you can find us again, our website, www.scifionscreen.com. We have a Facebook page, and on any smartphone, you could search for us on the podcast app and subscribe. Thanks again. See you next time.